Sign Language with Bruce Williams.
Hi, and welcome to episode 157 of Sign Language. A few things to cover this week. The first was an email that came up to me a couple of weeks ago now from iZotope. I'm naturally on their email marketing distribution list. And it's a new, I guess a subdomain that they've launched, pae.izotope.com, and it's Pro Audio Essentials. And essentially what it is, it's a training ground, and it's completely free. And there's a whole bunch of different things that you can not only get educated about, but also test your ears on. Now, obviously, I don't mean test your hearing as in take a hearing test, but the ability to listen to sample files and try and identify what sort of EQ has been applied or what sort of compression has been applied, things like that. Anyway, it's a really good looking site. I had a brief play with it for an hour or so, a week or so back, and really enjoyed it. And I found some of the EQ testing to be quite challenging. So if you're interested in, sharpening up your ears, definitely check that out. There's some good stuff there, and just, some good basic grounding in theory if you feel like you're lacking in any of it and need a bit of a refresher. There's some good info there, so check that out. Next up, I heard from Rob Bettler. When Rob sends me an email, I know it's been a little bit too long between episodes, so I figure it's time to get the finger out and get a new episode recorded. Rob's email is titled, "The Imaginary Value of Music." "Lately, I've been using Spotify, and the results have been rather mixed, simply because their freemium model falls short compared with piracy." There, I just said it. Allegedly, I am not the only music pirate on the internet. Despite all this, I decided to upgrade and tried the paid subscription for a month. This trial gave me a very clear idea of what modern exploitation means, because Spotify is paying artists about 0.006 to 0.0084 of a dollar per stream, which is only fractions of a cent. The result? Spotify pays nearly nothing to the artists. Then, Taylor Swift threw a tantrum and famously quit Spotify because she was only getting less than $250,000 per song. Oh, please, someone stream the world's smallest violin for Taylor. Then, the competition to Spotify, called Tidal, which is owned by Jay-Z, claims to pay artists more, but the company is struggling with basic technical things such as songs failing to play, or even multi-million dollar lawsuits. Things are getting so bad for Tidal that executives are jumping ship and the company is even failing to make ends meet. In short, Tidal may even soon die as a company. The moral of the story seems to be that if you do not rip off the artists, like Spotify, you go broke, like Tidal. What a nightmare for the artists. Can the nightmare get worse? Of course. Simply because the old and ailing record industry could then easily tell a few of the artists running from streaming services the following convenient lie. See? Told you so. Come back with us. We won't rip you off as much this time around. Again, this must really suck for artists because this forces them to choose from a lesser evil, which eventually stifles their art, and once again they become the victims of the record industry. To add insult upon the injury, the root of all this evil seems to be that people are just too stingy to pay a fair price for streaming music. Or are they? See, I sincerely doubt someone like Hendrix would stand a chance to become a legend nowadays, because in today's world, there's simply too much competition and saturation of the market. Most likely, in today's world, Hendrix would be a barista with a penchant for video games or a Guitar Hero player at best. Nowadays, the bar has been set too high, and the supply is so excessive that it makes it difficult for excellent music to set itself apart from the noise. Okay, I'm just going to jump in here, Rob. On one hand,
Yes, I agree that music production has absolutely saturated the market, and the home recording technological boom has hands down been responsible for that. You know, through to the, I'd say the mid-90s, if you wanted to record music, you had to have the budget to go and, you know, book time in a recording studio. And if you didn't have that money, you know, hoped that your product was good enough to get a record company interested, and they would then fund your recording session for you. But, you know, as the technology for home recording, you know, blossomed in the mid-90s and, you know, really burst into flower in the noughties, that has given every man and his dog with a song to sing the opportunity to record at home, mix at home, master at home, if so be it. You know, the internet obviously has allowed, you know, mass distribution of all this product. And I said, you know, on one hand, I agreed. On the other hand, I disagree in your argument about quality. I think quality music will always get found, and I think it's because of that very same internet. You know, the social web enables people to discover music so much easier now than there was anything 20 years ago. You know, the best thing you had 20 or 30 years ago was trading tapes with your mates. You know, hey, I heard this great album, you got to have a listen to this, you know, so you'd run off a cassette copy and you give it to your mate. And yeah, that was pretty much the limit of, you know, music discovery beyond what you heard on the radio, you know. And let's face it, radio has always had a very limited playlist, simply because the radio station owners are always trying to fit within a format. So, you know, they keep their playlist very tight, and, you know, they research the crap out of it, and they only play the stuff that researches really well. So, you know, I think, yeah, you're absolutely right. There is an oversupply, but I also think the good music, while it might represent a smaller fraction of the gross international product, shall we say, to coin a phrase, it's still going to get discovered because of the social web, you know. I can think of at least two artists that I have, you know, been made aware of over the last 2 or 3 years. One was Jason Isbell, former guitarist and singer for the Drive-By Truckers, and a guy that I was introduced to only a couple of months ago, Nathaniel Ratliff and the Night Sweats. Horrible name, but unbelievable album. And, you know, both of those artists were artists that I probably would never have discovered on my own. And it was only through, you know, talking with people with like-minded musical interests who pointed me towards these artists, you know. And that, you know, I just think that social side of the web makes music discovery so much easier now. And then you've got so many sites that are dedicated to music discovery. Hey, you know, type in the name of an artist you like and we'll suggest artists that you might also like but don't know about. Yeah, there's heaps of websites like that. So anyway, back to Rob's email.
Which brings us back to square one again. What's the authentic fair price for music? How much would be fair to pay artists for their work? Or a much worse question, what if the pittance that artists are getting on Spotify and Tidal is the authentic price of music?
Just going to jump in there, Rob, and say I assume what you meant is, you know, what if that pittance is the authentic value of music? I'm putting words in your mouth here, but hopefully that's what you meant.
So again, let's just cut to the chase and answer the question. What is the authentic fair price of music? Answer: I think that we live in a world of fictitious value attached to music. Music is overpriced, and Spotify is close to the mark. Music should be free, and artists should make money out of touring. If you cannot play live and tour, you make no money. Plain and simple.
Okay. pretty harsh there, Rob, but yeah, I can see your point. Yeah, there certainly was a time where you know, if you didn't have the skills to get on stage and play your music live, then you really had no career. You know, that was always considered an essential requirement for any artist to be signed to a record label, was their ability to go out and play a live show and hold the attention of a crowd. If they couldn't do that, then they weren't worth the time and the investment, you know, to produce the product. But of course, over time, the goals changed, you know, and we moved away from the art of the music to how good does it look and can we sell a zillion copies and then move on when everyone, you know, has exposed the fraud for what it is. Unfortunately, that's the nature of the game now. And I remember going to a music business meeting probably 10 years ago now and hearing a guy who had been involved in the whole of, you know, sort of live touring and concert promotion side of the industry. And he said that the majority of tours which make profit do so off the merch. It's not off the ticket sales. So, yeah, I don't know how accurate that is. This guy had runs on the board and, you know, he had years of industry experience, so I assume that he knew what he was talking about, but I haven't seen any other evidence to support that claim, but I'll assume that he, you know, was telling the truth. Anyway, moving on.
However, touring, making money, and the resulting excess from touring is not new. Gifted musicians throughout history have had a relatively easy job compared to many other human beings simply because they were born, well, musically gifted. The more gifted the musician is, the more likely they are to find success. With success usually comes the money, then the excess, then an overdose. Sad but true. Janis Joplin, Jim Morrison, Kurt Cobain, Amy Winehouse, and the list goes on. All of them died too young and too talented. Virtuosi like them are too good and too emotional at what they do. As a result, it just becomes too easy to become complacent and indulge in terminal forms of excess such as drugs. You do not get musical greatness without a highly emotional individual, and intense emotions come at a cost, often suicide. In an ideal world, artists will be signed by streaming companies, given a retirement plan and preemptive therapy for their emotional struggles and substance abuse, or in other words, a suicide prevention plan. Would this retirement plan work? Sadly, I doubt it, because it seems that extremely gifted artists are predestined to join the 27 Club, or to quote Cobain and Def Leppard, for them it's better to burn than to fade away. Damned if you do and damned if you don't. Damned if you are musically gifted and successful, and damned if you are gifted but unsuccessful. For some screwed up reason, it seems that regardless of skill, both complete financial success or failure are terminal states for artists. Conclusive art. In conclusion, if I were a member of a band, I'd probably be pretty demotivated business-wise. But artistically? Not so much. See, here's the last inconvenient truth of this rambling. If what drives an artist to make art is money, it never was art. In my opinion, authentic artists will be creative even in the direst of situations. It sucks, but it seems that adversity is the authentic soul of sublime art. Art through adversity. How about you and your audience, Bruce? What would be the authentic value of music to you?
Well, I have to say that I now subscribe to Google Play Music, have been subscribing to that for probably 8 or 10 months, and absolutely love it. And I was paying $11.99 Australian per month until last week when I got a text message from Google saying, your Google Play Music subscription is dropping in price from $11.99 a month to $9.99 a month, and we've now thrown in YouTube Red. So, you know, I was paying $12 a month, now I'm paying $10 a month, and I love it because it gives me access to, you know, 99% of the stuff I want to hear. you know, there are a few, you know, unknown, unsigned artists that I know of around the world whose music I love who probably won't ever end up on Google Play. But they're certainly the, you know, the very thin wedge of the pie. The majority of the stuff that I want to hear or am already familiar with and want to continue listening to is already there. And for $10 a month, I can consume as much as I like. You know, I have a 70 to 75 minute commute twice a day on my motorbike, and I have 7 gigs of data on my mobile plan per month. And, you know, I probably use 3.5 or 4 gigs a month of that 7 gigs, streaming podcasts and music to my earbuds while I'm riding. Yeah, so $10 a month, to me, that's great. I think that's great value. I think it's... I don't know what Google Play pays artists. I don't know what the rate is. I mean, it's probably not much different to Spotify, at a guess. I don't know. But, you know, for the majority of my, you know, mobile listening, or if I'm just having a, you know, some friends over for a barbie here at home, streaming music is perfect. I'll just, you know, put on Google Play Music and I can choose one of the predefined radio stations, or I can just queue up a few albums and just hit play and hit randomize or whatever I want to do. And that's great. And then for the odd things that, you know, come across my radar that are albums that I know, you know, are going to mean a lot to me, even, you know, 10 years or 20 years from now, those I'll go out and buy on vinyl. I rediscovered vinyl, you know, probably 3-4 years ago, and that's pretty much how I buy my new music these days. You know, other than my Google Play Music subscription, any new music I buy on vinyl. The odd exception to that is things like Springsteen's The River reissue box, which was, you know, DVDs and CDs, but I bought that more for all of the extras than for the music itself, because I've already got it, you know, already got The River on both CD and on vinyl, so I didn't need a third copy, but I have it anyway. So yeah, so for me, $10 a month for Google Play Music, great value. Whether it's fair value for the artist, I don't know. I really don't know. I don't know how they divvy that $10 up. You know, do they calculate every song that I play over the course of a month and assign a share of that $10 to each of those artists? I don't know. No idea how it works. Yeah, hopefully it works something like that. Anyway, Rob continues,
I could definitely be mistaken, and I would be eager to hear any brutally honest feedback. Beast regards, the sexy guacamole beast, Rob Bettler.
I have no idea what that sign-off meant, but anyway. So, yeah. Well, I think I've covered all of the points that I wanted to make regarding that, Rob, so thank you. Rob then sent me an email separately to this and said,
what do you know, an Australian company selling snake oil, headphones that listen to the bones inside our ears to equalize the music.
Link will be in the show notes for anyone that wants to check this out. Basically, these headphones are an over-the-ear design, but with a earbud type contraption that, you know, sticks into the middle ear canal, and you then have to run an app on your smartphone, which then, you know, and you need to do this in a quiet room, and it plays some tones to you and analyzes what, I don't know how it supposedly knows what you heard, but anyway, they reckon that it does, and it then applies this EQ modeling to whatever music you play, so that in theory it's given you the best interpretation of the music according to your natural frequency spikes and dips in your hearing. Gotta say, I think it's too finicky a product to set up, too expensive, and if it even gets off the ground, I think it'll be the kind of product that will only appeal to well-heeled audiophile gadget lovers. Outside of that, I can't see much of a market for it. And I think Rob's probably in the same boat. Anyway, the other night I did get a message on Facebook from Carol Weiss, and he asked me,
"Hey Bruce, I have a maybe stupid question, but please, why are we using reel-to-reel tape recorders and not cassette tape? I understand if you want to record a multi-track, you can use a reel-to-reel and you can cut it, but is the sound different? Thanks, Carol."
Now, I wrote back to Carol and I said, who uses either these days? I mean, there are still a handful of little analog studios around the world who are maintaining their multi-track tape machines, but geez, I'd hate to be on the hunt to buy multi-track tape these days. I don't know how many companies would be producing it anymore, because I know Ampex became Quantigy, and I know Quantigy have shut up shop and gone home. Oh, geez, that'd have to be over 10 years ago now. I don't know who else was making tape. I think Agfa were making tape, and in my experience, it was crap. I never liked working with Agfa multi-track tape. It always seemed very stretchy. It would stretch at the drop of a hat. In every studio I ever encountered it, I always found the same thing. But yeah, BASF, I think, used to do multi-track tape, but whether or not they still exist, I have no idea. Anyway, I then went on. But I think I understand your question. The main difference between reel-to-reel tape and cassette tape was the length that could fit on a spool, which then dictated both thickness and speed. Now, thickness would obviously play a part in the stretchiness of the tape, and maybe that was Agfa's problem, maybe it was just they made it too thin, I don't know. Thickness of the tape stock determines how much print-through you would get, and print-through was this phenomenon where when you spool a tape onto a plastic spool, the recording at one point on the tape would print through onto the next layer of tape around the loop. And sometimes with analog recordings, if you had an analog reel-to-reel tape recorder, you would press play, and just a split second before the audio started, you would hear this really low-level ghost image of the beginning of the audio. And that was the print through coming from the next layer of tape around the loop, around the hub of the of the reel. And it was for that reason that in the analog days, we always used to store tapes tail out, which meant instead of rewinding them so that the beginning of the tape was on the outside of the spool, we would actually fast forward the tape off the left-hand side feeder spool onto the take-up spool, which was on the right-hand side of the machine. So you took the reel off the machine, and the tape that was at the outside of the spool was actually the tail end of the tape, hence why we used to call it tail out. And the reason for doing that was that then the print through would end up behind, it would be like an echo trailing the signal rather than leading the signal. But anyway, I'm getting completely off the track here. So the thickness of the tape stock would determine how much print through occurred. And the length of the tape meant you could run at higher record and playback speeds. So cassettes ran at 1.75 inches per second, whereas reel-to-reel tape was usually used at either 7.5 or 15 inches per second. And the higher tape speed meant less tape hiss, not sure why, just always seemed to be the case. And it also meant much better high frequency response, which I assume, never really thought about why that might be the case, but I assume it's something, in some way parallel to the idea of using higher sampling rates. I mean, I understand sampling rates, because that's all about how often we measure the changing voltage of a signal, and therefore the more often we sample that voltage, then the higher the frequency we can store, as per Nyquist's theorem, that you need double the sampling rate of the highest frequency you want to save. Why would higher tape speed give better high frequency response? Rowan Matthews or Steve Hope could probably weigh in on this. Guys, love to hear from you. If you can explain why higher tape speeds gave a better high frequency response, love to hear it. I'm sure I knew the answer at one point in time, but it's been so long since I worked on tape. And maybe if I sat down and thought about it for a while, the answer would come back to me, but it escapes me right at this point in time. Anyway, and speaking of Rowan Matthews, I want to publicly thank him. I thanked him personally, but over the last few months, I've had this really weird problem with my Genelec monitors here in my home studio, where I would be sitting here working away, you know, maybe mixing a song or mixing a podcast, and all of a sudden the right-hand speaker would start to fade out. And over a period of 20 or 30 seconds, it would just completely fade out to nothing. And I found that I would have to turn the speaker off, because they're powered speakers. So I'd turn the power switch off on the front of the right-hand speaker, give it 5 seconds, flick it back on, and boom. Signal was back. And so I was convinced that this must be a, you know, slowly degenerating amplifier circuit or a resistor or a capacitor or something inside the speaker that was on the way out, and that it was just this intermittent, you know, randomly occurring problem, and, you know, there was nothing finite I could point to. So I rang the shop that I bought these speakers from 7 years ago, and I told them the story, and I said, who do I send Genelec speakers to in Australia? And they said, did you buy them from us? And I said, yeah, I did. And they said, well, bring it in here and Lewis will have a look at it for you. And I went, okay, sweet. So I took the speaker into him, and he had it for a week or so, and I rang him back and I said, what's the story? And he said, mate, I've been bench testing your speaker nonstop for, you know, 4 or 5 days. He said, it hasn't failed yet. And I went, well, that's bizarre. So I said, okay, I'll come and pick it up. So went and picked it up, and I thought, well, if it's not the speaker, the only other thing it can be is wiring. But the symptoms did not suggest that it was a wiring issue. You know, I've never known dodgy wiring to cause a speaker to suddenly fade out over 20 or 30 seconds. You know, this everything suggested that it was a problem with the amps, you know, in the amp circuit in the speaker. So anyway, pull all the cables apart, and what do you know, I find, you know, a solder joint that's, you know, come apart. It was obviously not soldered well, and obviously I'd soldered it a long time ago, because I just took one look at it and went, oh my god, that's rough soldering work. Clearly my skills have improved over the years. Yeah, so I ended up pulling all of these cables apart and checking the connections, and the thing was, even though the way I had soldered these speaker cables up, and these cables run out of my analog mixer to the speakers. Now, the thing is that the outputs from the mixer are unbalanced, tip and sleeve, but the inputs to these Genelec monitors are balanced on XLRs. And so I was Googling wiring diagrams to make sure I'd wired them up correctly, and I discovered that it appeared that the, you know, accepted method for terminating these cables, you know, certainly going from unbalanced to balanced, was different to what I had initially executed. I mean, what I'd done had worked, but obviously it wasn't the standardized way of, you know, unbalancing a speaker cable. So I reached out to Rowan, and thankfully he was online at the time that I reached out to him, and I was able to fire the question off to him, you know, how should I terminate these? And he confirmed that, you know, what I was seeing on these, you know, images online was the correct way of doing it. So, yeah. So I just want to say thanks, mate. I appreciate that. I went ahead, resoldered all of the connections on my interconnects from the analog mixer to the speakers, and yeah, it's bizarre. Haven't had one instance of this speaker misbehaving since. So clearly it was a wiring issue, but certainly not anything I'd ever encountered like I said, the symptoms did not suggest that it was a wiring problem. There you go. All right, that will do it for this episode. Love to hear feedback. Please drop me an email, studio@audiotu.com. If there's any topics you'd love me to cover that I haven't already covered, please be like Rob. Send me an email. More than happy to hear from other listeners if you're out there. All right, until I speak with you next, take care.
Sign language. For questions, comments, and feedback, email studio@audiotou.com.